Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Most of the rain in the first week of September fell across the South. That led to some local improvements in topsoil moisture. But nationally, we continue to inch upward on very short to short ratings and have now reached 47%, the highest number we've seen so far this year. That is up a point from last week. Topsoil moisture surplus, only 4% nationally. No change from last week.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
I also want to mention that Louisiana expecting copious rain from Francine. Also had a pretty wet week, but a lot of that wetness confined to the southern part of the state, and statewide just 15% surplus. So hopefully most areas in the Delta and elsewhere in the Central Gulf Coast region will be able to withstand some of this rainfall from Francine without huge impacts.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Now, there is no greater example of bureaucratic overreach than a nightmare complying with and understanding the definition of a water of the United States, or WOTUS as we call it.
At a hearing last week with the House Subcommittee on Water Resources and Environment, Chairman from North Carolina, David Rauser.
This definition determines the scope of jurisdictional waters under the Clean Water Act, affecting water quality certification programs, pollutant discharge permits, and oil spill prevention. Now, a good example of all this is in North Carolina, pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk, a worldwide leader in treating and preventing a wide range of diseases, including diabetes, announced a $4 billion investment for a site expansion, bringing more than 1,000 jobs to the state. In October, they requested a jurisdictional determination, or JD as we call it, which never came. They were told to apply for a permit to modify it once a JD was issued. They have since applied for a permit without determination. However, the permit process, review process, can take more than a year. Novo Nordisk cannot conduct on-site avoidance and minimization analysis before they know what parcel of property must be avoided, nor can they conduct an off-site alternatives analysis without a clear concept of how their site works against other sites that may or may not have similar issues. And this is just one example of many instances across the country where economic investment and job creation, and in this case, public health as well, are all stalled due to this vague process. The Supreme Court's ruling in Sackett versus EPA last year provided a decisive win for America's farmers, small businesses, and property owners. Yet despite the court's clarity, there remains a distinct incongruence between the ruling and the latest definition of a WOTUS from this administration, which has led to a new round of legal challenges and additional confusion. When Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works, Michael Connert, testified before the subcommittee last December, he reported a backlog of more than 4,000 jurisdictional determinations that need to be made. While the administration claims some progress has been made in improving these, the inconsistent and piecemeal approach it is taking in implementing its WOTUS rule is causing serious delays on a variety of different projects around the nation. Sackett struck down the significant nexus test and held that a WOTUS must have a continuous surface connection to traditional navigable waters. That ruling was over a year ago, and we just passed the one-year mark since the administration issued its revised rule. Farmers, home builders, businesses, manufacturers, and many other hardworking Americans rely on the Corps and EPA for predictable, workable, and stable WOTUS regulations. The administration has not yet delivered. So in summation, the administration's implementation is not in accordance with the Sackett ruling generally, nor is it consistent project to project where JDs have been issued. So I remain concerned about the lack of transparency and lack of consistency with which this revised definition has been implemented. We are all still waiting for clear and consistent guidance on which everyone can rely. The decision to approach WOTUS on site-specific basis without clear training and universal application has served only to muddy the waters, no pun intended, of a very clear and straightforward Supreme Court ruling. So I look forward to hearing from our witnesses today about their experiences and challenges with WOTUS implementation since the Sackett decision and what recommendations they have for us in Congress so we can work to provide surety to Americans who rely on clear implementation of this important rule.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Vice President Harris is working to build an opportunity economy where farmers, ranchers, and rural communities can thrive.
At a recent Farm Foundation forum on agriculture under a new administration, Rod Snyder, former senior ag advisor at EPA.
This starts by ensuring that producers of all sizes have access to diverse markets, a robust safety net, a reliable workforce, an innovation pipeline, and a level playing field with competitors around the world. It's also vitally important that rural communities, where most of our food is grown, are healthy and thriving places. Over the past 4 years, through the American Rescue Plan, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden and Vice President Harris have made unprecedented investments in these very places. Includes just the recent announcement about nearly $10 billion to help member-owned rural electric cooperatives provide their communities with clean, reliable, and affordable energy, the single largest investment in rural electricity since FDR, more than $50 billion to improve water infrastructure, including removing lead pipes, strengthening wastewater and drinking water systems, and addressing drought, connecting nearly a million rural Americans to high-speed internet through USDA's ReConnect program, and more than $4 billion to support 1,300 rural transit systems around the country. These investments are already having an impact. The USDA ERS 2023 Rural America at a Glance report shows that rural population is growing again after a decade of overall population loss.
Snyder contrasting what a Harris administration might look like compared to a Trump administration.
By contrast, the 4 years of the Trump presidency was defined by chaos and uncertainty for the farm economy, and the outlook for a second term would be even more severe. National Corn Growers former CEO John Doggett wrote in AgriPulse just last week, "There are things former President Trump has said that should raise significant concerns for anyone making a living in agriculture. If enacted, the policies he says he supports would make life more uncertain for those who work to put food on our tables." And I could not agree more with John. This election is a choice between certainty and chaos for farmers and ranchers across the country. During his prior term, Trump's trade war cost American farmers $29 billion in lost exports in 2018 and 19 alone, while undermining markets that took decades for our farmers to build. And his most recent proposal of 10 to 20% across-the-board tariffs for all imported products would lead to further loss of global market share for U.S. agriculture, not to mention rapid inflation for consumers. In terms of farm labor, a second Trump term would be equally devastating. Roughly 70% of ag workers in the United States are foreign-born, and nearly half of those are undocumented. Trump is promising mass deportation on an unprecedented scale without any consideration for our country's ag system, food prices, or least of all, the human toll. There are thoughtful, bipartisan proposals in Congress to address ag workforce challenges and legal pathways. However, former President Trump would prefer to throw our country's farms and food system into chaos rather than forge a meaningful solution to the decades-long problem. For our friends in the corn and soybean space, our corn and soy farmers, biofuels have become an important domestic market. And yet the Trump administration left the renewable fuels standard in disarray. Trump's EPA issued handouts to oil refineries that undercut renewable fuel production by nearly 4 billion gallons during his time in office. He departed the White House in 2021 without setting any mandatory volumes for ethanol or biodiesel that year. More uncertainty, more chaos. Lastly, President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, joining only Iran, Libya, and Yemen as nations outside of the historic international agreement, and he dismantled major climate initiatives across the federal government. By contrast, the Biden-Harris administration has invested heavily in voluntary, farmer-led climate and sustainability initiatives that are helping position America's farmers and ranchers as leaders in the low-carbon economy while building the long-term resiliency of our agricultural sector.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Paul Mikesell. Paul is the founder and CEO of Carbon Robotics and the Laser Weeder. Is that right?
Laser Weeder, yep, correct. Yeah, and I am Paul Mikesell. Hello.
Okay, so Paul, tell us a little, first off, about the company.
Yeah.
And how you came up with the company.
Been working on the Laser Weeder for 4 years. We realized that AI and robotics needed to get into agriculture. So we dove in head first and just kept going and working hard until we figured out what would work. What works for weed control? AI, computer visions, and really high-powered lasers. So our machines, we find those weeds in the fields live. Our AI system is evaluating what it's seen in the camera. It says weed, weed, weed. It puts the lasers on them, kills all the weeds, keeps your field clean. No herbicides, no people out there pulling weeds. It's a win-win.
Now, so when we talk about weeds, what's the technology that goes behind, say, whether it's corn or cotton. Yeah. First off, I guess what commodities are you in?
Sure, and
how does it know it's a weed?
Yeah, okay, great. So we focus a lot on specialty and vegetable crops. So we do a lot of onions, broccolis, cauliflowers, a lot of lettuces, spinach, spring mix, that kind of thing, a lot of carrots. We've done some organic corn, some organic soy, that kind of stuff. Typically, your kind of higher value crops where they're gonna, and we've got some videos here of, these are spinaches, really high density spinaches. So how does it know what's a weed, what's a crop? So this is a subsection of AI called deep learning. Is there deep learning neural nets? It's the same kind of technology that like ChatGPT, you probably heard about that. So that's a neural net. So we use a computer vision version of that same kind of technology. We take a bunch of images, we tell the computer this is a weed, this is a crop, this is a weed, this is a crop. Computer learns that. And then we take that piece of the computer that has learned that, put it in the robot, connect it up to the lasers, here we go.
Wow. Yep. Okay, so if we were using herbicides, we'd have to be refilling the tank. Do you have to refill the laser?
No, those lasers are good. They're self-contained, they run, we just put some voltage into it, out comes a mix of plasma, and that creates heat energy. And our machine knows how to put that heat energy right on the right spot of the plant to burn it and make it die. No refill on the lasers. They're good, sealed, self-contained unit.
Okay, so you were here last year.
Yeah.
What's different?
Yeah, this is the same laser weeder we brought out last year. So what's different, we've added a lot of software functionality. So there's a lot of new crop models, so we can do over 40 crops now. And the big thing is that we're announcing this year, just announced actually, we do not only laser weeding, but we'll also do laser thinning. So if you want to go out and you want to thin your crops to stand, we can do that. So we can clean out your weeds and thin your crops at the same time. A laser weeder can do it all, and that's doable just with the software upgrade. So we did the hardware once, and we did it right, and then new software on top of that, on top of the existing hardware platform.
So you're already out in the field, multiple states. What states?
We got machines right now in California, Arizona, New Mexico, Washington. And then this year, we're deploying to about 6 or 7 new states in the United States. Got some machines going to Canada. We're going to ship about 3 to 4 times as many machines this year as we did last year. So we're really ramping up volume to keep up with demand for the laser weeder.
Wow. We want to find you. Where do we do that?
CarbonRobotics.com. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Twitter, all the social media networks. Hopefully you'll find us in the field near you soon.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Our members are committed to protecting our natural resources while maintaining their businesses. They live in the communities where they work and understand their responsibility in keeping our waterways healthy.
Courtney Briggs is chair of the Waters Advocacy Coalition, testifying before a House Subcommittee on Water Resources and Environment.
However, the Biden administration's interpretation and implementation of WOTUS lacks clarity and certainty for landowners and businesses and stretches the federal government's jurisdictional reach beyond the limits of what is legal. Over the last few years, we've seen the Biden administration offer a new WOTUS definition. The Supreme Court hand down a highly consequential decision in Sackett, and then the agencies respond with a conforming rule in numerous agency memos. Despite a clear ruling in Sackett, there have been no clear directions from the agencies about which water features are regulated by the federal government and which are left to the states. Instead, the agencies are making up the rules as they go. They have failed to clarify the meaning of relatively permanent and continuous surface connection, which are crucial terms for defining the scope of federal jurisdiction. It seems the agencies want to leave these terms undefined, allowing them to exploit the gray areas that persist in a post-Sackett world. By leaving these terms undefined, the agencies gain unchecked power to regulate land and natural resources, creating murky waters for regulated entities. In this ambiguous regulatory regime, American businesses and landowners are left guessing where the line of jurisdiction lies, despite the severe penalties for Clean Water Act compliance. Either $64,000 per day for every day of noncompliance or jail time. It is thus all too easy for our members to unknowingly break the law. To put it simply, WAC members are tired of playing the agency's never-ending guessing games. The agencies have also neglected to provide clear implementation guidance to stakeholders. Instead, WAC members began hearing feedback that secret implementation guidance was being distributed by Corps headquarters to the districts, with strict instructions not to share publicly. The agency's refusal to release the secret guidance forced many WAC members to submit FOIA requests. The agencies responded with substantially redacted text, stating that the guidance was deliberative. How can something that is being used on the ground to make determinations that directly impact regulated parties be deliberative? The agency's implementation improv is putting our members' projects and the communities that rely on them at risk. This is a flagrant abuse of power and a blatant disregard for government transparency. Rather than offering clear guidance, the agencies are relying on memos haphazardly placed on their website with little public notice. Each memo gives a small snippet as to how they are implementing this rule, leaving stakeholders to play connect the dots with their livelihoods on the line. Many of the concepts outlined in these memos run counter to the decision in Sackett. The agencies offer no mechanism for appealing the memos, no opportunity for public comment. These memos are effectively rulemakings hiding in plain sight. It is unacceptable that 1.5 years since Sackett, the agencies continue to flout the court's ruling and hold project proponents and states hostage in regulatory limbo. Our nation's job creators, small businesses, farmers, landowners, and even states remain in the dark about how the rule is being implemented. This is especially concerning given the serious penalties for even negligent Clean Water Act violations, such as simply moving dirt in the wrong place. The agencies seem more interested in charting their own course than adhering to the Supreme Court's decision.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I talk about this productivity a lot.
At a recent Farm Foundation forum of agriculture under a new administration, Kip Thom, a former ambassador in the Trump administration.
Really sets in my mind when I listened to my father talk before he passed about 2.5 years ago. We went to the farm where he first walked in a furrow behind his father, behind horses, and looked at that field. And we talked about life, talked about farming. And it's the same field that I went to as a child and walked behind my father as he laid that first furrow. Dad looked at me and said, when I was a boy, this field yielded 30 bushel per acre. What did it yield this year? I said, 240. Eightfold increase. Imagine the innovation that started in the United States that allowed this to happen. We need to untether that innovation once again. We cannot let Washington, D.C. get in the way. We cannot let government get in the way of bringing new innovations to the marketplace. So I'm fortunate. I've lived the American dream. My parents raised 5 children. We started out with 120 acres. We were in 4-H, FFA, went to church, worked in the community. I lived the American dream. We invested. We worked hard. We took risk. And that's not uncommon throughout agriculture. I could take you across the Midwest, the West Coast, or the East Coast, anywhere in the country, and you can find people that live that American dream. So my message to you today is this. Let's make sure that we set policy in place. Let's make sure we have a dialogue that allows the American dream to stay alive, because it's got us where we are today, which is why I got involved with the Farmers and Ranchers for Trump 47 Coalition. We looked at the risk that was being posed upon us by the Biden-Harris administration, and now the Harris-Waltz administration that comes to reality. You know, one of the biggest significant issues I see us being faced with is probably death tax. What is being proposed today will nearly double the amount of farmers and ranchers that will have to pay inheritance taxes, money they've already paid taxes on, and now when they transition that to the next generation, will continue to pay taxes. It could be the most undermining issue, taking away the farms and the ranches as we know them today, having to sell off assets to continue their family legacy of producing food, fiber, and energy. I look at the regulatory issues in our country. Under the Biden-Harris administration, they've created almost $1.67 trillion of new regulations. That's not only costing industries, this is costing farmers. This is costing the American consumer. That's why we see the 30% inflation is at the grocery store today. Kamala Harris needs to look no further for price gouging than to look in the mirror at herself. And like I said, under the Trump administration, he had nearly 50 trade deals, but we don't talk about that. They got the work done. Ambassador Dowd, Mr. Lighthizer, Secretary Lighthizer went to work and fixed a lot of these issues that came from the prior administration. They left agriculture in good shape when they left their offices back in January of 2020. They left trade deals that were working well for our country. Again, I'll say this, the 301 trade issues are still there today under the Harris administration. They still keep those tariffs in place, and we need to remember that. But we've had no trade deals under the Harris administration, none. And that's why we see a decline in our export sales of nearly $42.5 billion this next year. We were on an increase until Donald Trump left office, and now we're seeing a decline. Now we're seeing a decline in farmers' income. Farm Bureau came out this past week, and they lowered their expectations on farm income to almost 50% from between 2022 and 2024. Now, that's a little different than the ERS document or numbers that came out that looked more broadly. But if you look at Midwest agriculture, you look at some of our livestock sectors, they're paying the price today for not having those trade agreements in place.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
What stands out to everybody are the food assistance or SNAP outlays. That has grown substantially since 2008 in the Great Recession.
Former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency is an ag policy expert at the University of Illinois, Jonathan Kappas.
Of course, the pandemic will have also impacted this, and so we will see an increase in that in the CBO baseline. But sometimes what we get lost in these big numbers are the realities of these two programs. And we are serving roughly above 40 million Americans who are low income, who are struggling to put food on the table. And the SNAP program provides them direct assistance to purchase food and to help them manage that series of challenges at the household and individual level. So it isn't, if all we do is look at the dollars, we tend to over-focus on SNAP as a blunt amount of spending. But when you think about the number of people who are being helped by this and being helped to purchase food, I think it puts that program in a different context.
Now, the 2018 Farm Bill has expired, been extended 1 year, and could be extended yet another year.
This Farm Bill's existence has been rather unusual in terms of Farm Bill history and expectations. This chart before you is a comparison of what was spent, 2022 forecast to be spent under the farm programs, that's the Navy bars, and then the supplemental and ad hoc programs that have kicked in since 2018 with the market facilitation program in 18 and 19, and then, of course, the coronavirus response programs and payments in 2020 and 2021 and into 2022. And so this is unusual for multiple reasons. It is rare to, in fact, it's never happened that we've seen this level of ad hoc spending on farmers in addition to farm program payments. It is unusual for there to be multiple years of this. Typically, we'd see an ad hoc, you know, in response to a drought or hurricane scenario. But to go through multiple programs over multiple years created using largely using the existing authorities and the Commodity Credit Corporation, it's pretty unusual to see that kind of year-over-year aspect. So almost the entire life of this farm bill has been shadowed by this ad hoc and supplemental spending. And then, you know, the other side is it's just unusual for there to be that much more spending through an ad hoc system than the authorized programs. What does this mean for a 2023 farm bill debate? I think is one of the big questions we have before us and that the committees have before them in this discussion. For one thing, it is certainly challenging perspectives around what spending goes out to farmers and how the programs work and look to them. Particularly under the coronavirus assistance programs, we provided assistance to a much larger population of farmers, a much larger set of crops, fruit and vegetable crops, livestock, who don't typically get Title I program payments. How does that impact their decisions and their requests in a farm bill? And how does that play out given the baseline limitations we have? So I think this is kind of one of those you know, as we look at our roadmaps, this is going to be one of those challenging areas on the path, sorting this out and helping particularly some of the farmers and crops who don't typically get assistance but have seen it in recent years leading into this farm bill. This is something we'll be watching and looking to discuss as we go.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This year, food shoppers have been seeing grocery prices each month either remaining stubbornly steady or going up. However,
grocery prices fell by 0.1% in August.
Yes, they fell. Not a huge drop, but USDA economist Megan Schweitzer told us it's a good sign for consumers.
This is the first time that we've seen grocery prices decline in 2024.
Megan says there are many possible reasons for the slowdown in food price inflation. Here are just a few.
After the price increases we saw over the past few years, there's been demand from consumers and pressure in retailers on manufacturers to sort of keep prices from rising even further. And so that, along with other factors such as lower energy and gas prices, have helped to slow rising costs.
The government's Consumer Price Index says grocery prices are averaging less than 1% higher than 1 year ago. Gary Crawford, Washington.